of the council and was asked to convene today. As you'll see, we'll do an introduction of everybody, which would be great. And then the next item on the agenda is the election of chair. I'm going to suggest that we hold that off until later in the meeting, just so everybody's had a chance to maybe learn a little bit more about people, and we can take that up later. Is that acceptable? All right, great. So, Mr. Hubinger, are you going to, would you like to start the introduction of members, or shall we just go around the table?
Perhaps you ought to do just the members first, just so we keep the line between staff and members clean.
Okay, well, just to clean it up right now, I don't know if all of you know Mr. Hubinger, but I've had the good fortune over the years to have some contact with him, so glad to have you here as staff. Mr. Berg, would you like to start us out and maybe tell a little bit about your...
Yeah. Got it. Okay. I'm, Tom Berg, appointed by the Chief Justice as my role here. From the judicial side of things. I'm a former state legislator. I served 8 years over here back in the 70s from part of Minneapolis, and was the United States Attorney in Minnesota for a while, so I've been involved in quite a bit of legal action as well as legislative action, and look forward to working on this to provide us that sensible level of compensation that we can get good folks in the government.
Thanks, Marilyn.
I'm Marilyn Dahlquist. I'm from Cambridge, and I am a public health nurse. I've been in nursing well over 25 years, done a lot of critical care nursing. As of recent, being in public health, I've done a lot of community stuff, been very active in getting as part of the county to get health programs going, and been very active in getting data on the community, and I watch the politics and stuff just to help out with the health part in the community.
Great, thank you. Keith?
Keith Swanson. I live in Hoffman, Minnesota, which is a little town west of Alexandria, so I was up early this morning. I am a former school administrator and have served as a county commissioner for the last 13 years.
Great, thank you. Annie.
Hi, my name is Annie Deckert. I live in Elk River, Minnesota. I have an economic development firm. We've been in business about 4 years. Prior to that, I worked for the city of Elk River for 5 years as the director of economic development in the city of Big Lake as a city planner for about 3 years.
I'm Steve Ludwig. I'm from St. Cloud. I retired about 4 years ago from the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I was an administrator at St. Cloud State in St. Cloud. So I thought this would be interesting. I've done a little work in negotiating on contracts within MNSCU, and so this is a little something different.
I'm Jim Robbins. The most relevant experience would be I spent a little over 12 years as a legislative staffer from about 93 to 90 or to 2005. I have a journalism background. I was editor at Northfield. Currently, I do some communications work for small cities and some energy grant writing.
Bob Meyerson from Atwater, Minnesota, 2 hours west of here on Highway 12, but I came there by way of New York City. I was born on Broadway, Broadway 190th, so I don't sing and dance, but I do dance a little bit. I have a PhD in European intellectual history, which I got in 1972. I hit the job market at a wonderful time. Nobody was interested in history. Nobody was interested in Europe, and they certainly weren't interested in a history of ideas. So after a few years of teaching, one-year jobs, my mother-in-law, who was president of the bank in Atwater, asked me to come into the bank until I found a job. I've been there ever since.
I'm Jim Fox. I'm from St. Paul area, and I also have a PhD, not a doc, physical doctor. I've been doing compensation consulting for 30-some years, and mostly it's been in government. So cities, counties, states, school districts, higher ed, just about anybody who gets paid salary, I've probably dealt with it somehow, somewhere. Currently, we're just working on a compensation study for the state of Rhode Island. We're doing the redoing the whole thing. So I've got a little bit of background on compensation.
I'm Dave Asp. I'm a lawyer at a firm Lockridge Grindle now in Minneapolis. I live in Plymouth, but I'm originally from Moorhead, Minnesota.
My name is Tom Evenson. I'm from the Maple Grove area, and I'm a shareholder at Lynn Jensen, Sullivan & Peterson, and I practice civil litigation.
Sarah Janicek, Minneapolis, appointed by the Chief Justice. I know where Hoffman is. I had a late uncle who lived in a home there for many years. I practiced law for a grand total of 4 months and then fell into politics, and I published Politics in Minnesota and was a lobbyist for 20-some years, and now I'm kind of not.
Good afternoon. My name is Jessica Macias. I am actually a fairly recent transplant to Minnesota. I've been here for, I guess, just over a year. I was in the military intelligence, in the Navy, for a little over 12 years, and now I'm a retail leader.
So my name is Alok Sharma. I'm also an attorney at a law firm in town called Foley Mansfield. I'm a commercial litigator. Went to law school at the U of M and moved here from D.C. and prior to that, Alabama. And when I was in D.C., I specialized in corporate taxation with Deloitte & Touche. And so I have a CPA, and then I came here for law school and then kind of fell in love with Minnesota, and here I am.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. My name is Anna Lima. I live in the North Loop in Minneapolis, in the heart of the city. I have my own law firm, mainly doing transactional work, some estate planning and probate. And I also am an adjunct professor at University of St. Thomas Law School.
Well, welcome, everybody. I'm Gail Olson. I served for many years in the State Attorney General's office, and a number of those years as a deputy to Attorney General Humphrey, and then became general counsel at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, served many more years there, had the opportunity to work with Mr. Ludwig and Mr. Hubinger while I was there. So, it's great to see everybody here. We'll have a chance to get to know each other a little bit more as we go along. We'll, as I said, can we do the introduction of staff? How about if we do that?
Sure.
All right.
I'm Greg Hubinger. I'm the director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. For some of you who may not be familiar with the structure of the legislature, imagine the House on one side and the Senate on the other side, and in between they have by statute established a number of commissions and task forces and councils that support the work of the House and Senate. I work for the Legislative Coordinating Commission, one of about 15 of those kinds of organizations. It's like a joint House-Senate committee. It's made up of members of both the House and the Senate, has 12 members on it, generally consists of the leadership from both bodies. We have two kinds of functions. One is to provide support for these kinds of groups of task forces and councils, and then we also do a bunch of administrative stuff that support HR and admin and benefits for the legislature. In our role of coordinating, we also work closely with House and Senate staff and sometimes folks from the administrative branch to provide support, and some of them are going to be providing testimony, but it might be helpful to get an introduction from them as well.
Great.
So, I'm Sally Olson with the Legislative Coordinating Commission as well.
I'm Casey Gerkovich, also with the Legislative Coordinating Commission.
And I'm Laura Garkensky with the Minnesota Department of Administration, so I'm going to be giving you a presentation shortly.
Is that it?
Ben Weeks and Stephanie James are in the back corner. They'll be providing support on an ongoing basis as well and doing presentations.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, and you're going to talk about administrative matters?
I think we'll leave that to Sally.
Sally?
Sure. So first, I just wanted to let everyone know this meeting is recorded. So, you know, we're recording. It'll be posted on the website. Number two, you all have a folder. There's a save folder. If there's any materials you want to keep, please put them in the save folder and leave them here. Take any materials with you. But if you can leave these folders here at the end of the meeting, that would be great, so we don't have to remake them. And then quickly, I sent you all an email about expense reimbursement and per diem. So there's a blue form in your packet. If you can fill that out before the end of the meeting so the chair can sign it, it helps facilitate it faster than if we get it later, at a later date. And I also sent notice that we do need a W-9 completed to enter you into the state system so we can process payment. And if you have any questions about that, you can connect with either me or Casey after the meeting. We can go over in more detail the expense reimbursement process.
Madam Chair, I'd add one item. Sally mentioned that the microphones are for recording, are for recording the meeting. They are not for amplification, so you have to pretend you're talking to the person on the opposite corner so that everyone can hear each other.
Thank you.
That'd be helpful.
That's good. Okay, are there questions about any of the administrative matters about parking or reimbursement or anything else at this point? And anybody that does have questions, Sally, we can direct them to you. All right. Anything else that you want to talk about for that? Okay. So
I do have a question.
All right.
Can someone give us guidance on what the usual protocol is, what to put in on the, or is that in the email that I missed?
There's actually a document in your folder, and if you want to catch one of us after, we can
thank you.
Help you too.
Any other questions? Okay, well, one of the people I had an opportunity to work closely with in my tenure as general counsel for what we now know as Minnesota State is lawyer Byer Kopensky, who is the data practices guru, as we like to say, and is an expert in a very complicated area that's relevant to our work here. So, lawyer, Lori.
Thank you very much, Gail. And as I mentioned earlier, if I'd known Gail was going to be on this group, I would have asked her to do this presentation.
Yeah.
Many of you may not know, the Department of Administration is home to a lot of very strange areas, data practices being one of them. We also have the state archaeologist, the state demographer, but we also helped build this building, helped restore that pretty building over there, so we have lots of different functions. But today you're going to be learning about data practices and open meeting law. So I have a small program that gives statewide advice to anyone who needs it, so both state and local government, as well as citizens and the media, on how to comply with both data practices as well as the open meeting law. We try and give lots of informal advice and try and make these complicated areas as simple as we can. The commissioner has the ability to do advisory opinions. We do a lot of legislative assistance, so no matter what crazy idea you have, we can help you write it so that it works within existing state and federal law. And then we also do trainings as well. And as I'm going, if you have any questions, Greg billed me as I had 20 minutes to cover both of these laws, so it's going to be going by really quickly. And I want you to be able to walk away knowing enough to kind of issue spot and know kind of where you should be turning to Greg and to Sally and kind of what are the things that you really just need to remember from you and how you work. So, starting off with that premise of, again, why is data practices important? And it really is all about, you know, if you think about the federal freedom of information, it's all about government transparency and accountability and making sure that we have a government that works for everyone, that we can really watch government doing their work. And it really is to promote the ability of citizens to be involved in their government. And our law is unique in that we believe that all data is going to be public, and that there's going to be data that's created related to the official activities of any group that then someone can make requests for. So an example of this would be your email correspondence related to this group would be something that would be subject to a data practices request. The one thing, this group has existed for some time, and from our standpoint of providing legislative drafting, we would really love that every statute is super clear and says this group is subject to Chapter 13 data practices and open meeting law, or it's not. The language of this statute is silent. with guidance from the Attorney General's office and with an abundance of caution, Greg and folks have decided you are going to operate as if you are subject to both of these laws. So that's why I'm going to be describing this for you. But the answer is not crystal clear. So, I had already mentioned that it defines what is government data. We have a presumption that everything in the world is public unless there's a specific law that makes it not public. Everything that you are going to be dealing with, from what I understand, is going to be straight up public data. So you do not have to worry about protecting any information. Like, everything you have is going to be just public data. Everything you get from anyone is going to be public. So you don't have those concerns. The Minnesota legislature has reserved the right to be able to decide what data is going to be not public. And we also provide rights to members of the public as well as data subjects. So when my data is about me, say at the Department of Public Safety, even though it might not be public, I have rights to it. So it really is, you know, you'll see this at state and local government. So if you've been on the county commission, this shouldn't be new. We also, school districts, data practices is set up in a very old-fashioned, siloed fashion with the premise that data siloed is much safer than if you have it all in big buckets. So if you wonder why does the city do it this way and a county does it this way and a school district does it differently and they all serve the same citizens, it's because data practices says it's safer to have things in different people's hands. And one of the last pieces in here is that the Data Practices Act doesn't apply to the legislature or to the judicial branch. So even though your work is going to be related to the judicial branch, and even though some of you were appointed by the Chief Justice and you're being supported by the legislature, typically they wouldn't be subject to these laws. So just something to know. There are two other laws when we talk about data practices. The Official Records Act, which you may hear in the news, as well as the records management statute. When government does its work, they've got certain official activities, and these laws basically require you to create records so that your successors in office can know what you've done and kind of why you've done it. And then records management statute details once you don't need a record any longer, kind of how you get rid of it and who gets it. And government data, so we have this bucket. I should have a little visual. It says official records is probably this little bucket here. Government data is everything that's in any kind of a recorded format. So every email that Jessica sends to Greg saying, I'm going to be 10 minutes late for the meeting, government data. Not anything that Greg or anyone needs to keep, but it's still something should you get a request that you might have to provide in response. So it really is the voicemail message. And what we're really realizing with the advent of technology, it used to be really difficult to prove violations of the open meeting law, but the way that people communicate now, there's a lot more evidence that, hey, they were texting during the meeting, or I can get a copy of that email where it shows that members were doing certain things. So these laws kind of work together sometimes and help each other out. This chart really is more detail than you need to know, as I described. Public data is available to anyone for any reason, even if it's a silly reason or what have you. Everything you're going to be touching is going to be public data. There are also these other classifications that detail who can have access and who can do what with it. So one of the things that you will need your staff to do is you are going to be appointing someone to serve as a responsible authority, and that is really a person on your staff who is going to be responsible for collection of all of and use of your government data. And then the law also, in state agencies, the responsible authority is usually the commissioner. And so the legislature decided they really wanted someone who actually fielded calls from the public. So they also put this other requirement of having a data practices compliance official. You can have one person serve in both roles, given how small you are, but that's a possibility. And you have to have two policies about responding both to public data requests as well as requests from data subjects when the data is about them. Greg and I talked a little bit before this meeting is he has another council, which is the compensation council, and you're the salary council, whichever way it goes, that you guys will probably share a set of policies and that the same people, given you don't have that many people to choose from, will do both functions for you. And given that you have a very short lifespan, I think it's just 3 months, you may not get very many requests. So, but this may be useful in the rest of your life when you want to make a request to your county board or your city council for data. So I thought that you might find this interesting. This just details information about all of you being appointed to this body of what is public. So both your name, your home address, your education and training, email address or telephone number. And just remember, especially since you're all volunteers and members of the public, it doesn't matter whether or not you are using a government computer, a government email, or just your personal devices. It's really about when you're doing the work of this group. It's, you know, subject to data practices and records. So it's not opening up everything on your iPhone. It might just be, do you have any emails that are responsive to a request about the council? And then Greg might ask you for them, and then you might provide them. It's not that you're going to be required to turn your phone in or anything like that. But it really is, if you have a notebook and someone's like, hey, I'd like to see Sarah's notebook. It really doesn't matter how you're doing data. It's really about the work. So technology doesn't have to be so complicated. It's really just if you think, I'm doing this work, and so this means it's something that someone else could make a request for. So, okay. Any questions kind of that I've prompted around data practices for you before I move in to the open meeting law? So, what we're going to cover today is really, you know, kind of what meetings are subject to the open meeting law, what kinds of types of meeting notices have to be provided, and then there's going to be some additional information about closed meetings and kind of just some special considerations, guidance, advice that I have for you in doing this work. So, as you guess, open meeting law means that meetings of public bodies are open to the public. Many times the public believes that means that they have a right to speak at meetings, and that's not what the law provides. It provides an opportunity for people to be able to sit in the audience and hear the discussion and the debate and see the most that you are working from. And the law is super short. Data practices law is super long. Open meeting law is super, I mean, it might be 10 pages long. And most of the important features have been detailed in case law. One of the most important pieces is the quorum rule. So that is one more than half. And that is when a quorum is together, that's when you have a meeting. And that when that majority discusses, decides, or receives information as a group related to their official activities. So that's kind of how you wind up having, you know, you have a group, you have a quorum of people discussing the work of this group, that's when we get meetings. And the open meeting law really is a notice law, so it really just provides a certain, you know, kind of they detail the different types of meetings. So you can have a regular meeting, or you can have special meetings. Given that this is your first meeting, this is a special meeting. If today you decided on the rest of your schedule for your meeting, then your only requirement would be to have a copy of that schedule on file at Greg's office. Otherwise, he's going to be doing a special 3-day advance notice every time you guys decide to have a meeting. I can expect that you'll have any emergency meetings, because the law doesn't detail what's an emergency, but many of the advisory opinions from the commissioner have talked about it can't be that someone's going on vacation and we really need to move this contract along before they go, that it really is about those natural disasters, something that really requires the body to get together before, you know, with less than 3 days' notice. So you, the roof caves in, and you've got to be able to meet and approve a replacement for the roof, things like that. But I don't expect you to probably have any one of those, but as soon as I say that, you know, maybe there will be an emergency in your world. Okay, so many of you are very active in your communities. You may run into each other even though you're from across the state. We do have advisory opinions both from the Commissioner of Admin as well as the Attorney General's office that says, you know, kind of meetings of less than a quorum don't count, and that you're allowed to go to social gatherings and retirement parties and banquets, and you can go to trainings as long as a group, even a quorum of you, can go to training, and you just can't talk about business. So doesn't matter if you're at the coffee shop, if there's a quorum of you and you start talking business, that's where someone's got to say, hey, didn't Lori say we shouldn't talk business when we're all together? You can go to parties. Just think about that. Stay in the social aspect. And this is where we get to kind of my unsolicited advice, where I talked about how showing violations of the open meeting law has gotten a lot easier because many of us are tied to our devices and we think of it as talking. Really don't have any discussion via email. That when you're going to have, like, hey, how are you going to vote, or I kind of like that idea, all of your discussion about the merits of what you're going to do really need to take place in this open setting. We had an advisory opinion on the gang strike force in 2009, and they had a press release that they wanted to approve. They were all chiming in on what it needed to include, and the commissioner said that was a meeting because they were all just kind of like, they waited until they had a majority of them saying, press release looks good. And that discussion was still considered a meeting, even though it was via email. And I assume the same thing would be true if you were doing it by text message. It's about if you are all, the majority of you are all weighing in on something and voting, that's going to trigger a meeting. The courts have also kind of tried to caution people of saying, you know, there are lots of ways that you can make sure a quorum of you aren't together, but if you have someone who's kind of going person by person saying, hey, Anna, how are you going to vote? you know, if you're doing meetings to kind of try and figure out, how do I get a quorum, a majority in advance of a meeting? How do I get an agreement of the parties? That can be a violation of the law as well. So try and have all of your discussions here. And oftentimes, members of the public, there'll be, you know, some local high-profile issue, and everyone will be there watching the meeting. When that topic comes up, they'll get this 100-page report, and then the chair calls for a vote, and there's no discussion, and everyone's like, yep, I'm in favor. And just people naturally believe that there have been offline conversations. So just keep your conversations here. This is just in here in case you are interested in the topic for other meetings. I don't expect you to have any meetings that are going to be closed, given what the things you're going to talk about. There is no general exception just because you're going to be talking about personnel-y kinds of things. And if you were going to close a meeting, you have to make a statement on the record, and then certain of those have to be recorded. One of the things that folks mentioned is that this is being recorded, but that's not a requirement of the open meeting law. You have an agenda today. That's also not a requirement of the open meeting law, but that's the way meetings function. You may use Robert Lee's order. That's also something open meeting law doesn't require. Okay. The law also allows you to have, and, you know, this is Minnesota, and it is still winter, so it does allow you to have electronic and telephone meetings with statewide bodies such as this. There's also a provision that talks about use of social media, that if you were going to, you know, kind of be talking about your official activity on social media, you have to accept all the friend requests. You can't have any kind of private crowd of Twitter followers or Facebook followers that you allow to see certain messages. So everything would have to be kind of open. So I don't know that any of you would have that in your professional work.
Lori, can you just talk a little bit more about participation by telephone and what would be required if we do want to allow that?
You know, what's interesting is there are a couple different provisions, and I didn't bring the whole thing with me.
Okay.
One of them is you have to have at least, you know, kind of, you have to notice that that you're going to have a telephone meeting. You're going to have to give the public an opportunity to be able to kind of log in. At least one person has to be at the regular meeting location. So there are a couple different provisions that allow you to have, say, a solely telephone meeting, or ones with an opinion that says Skype, where you can see and hear people, is the same thing as a, you know, a meeting, and that complies as well. So very technical requirements around that.
Well, I anticipate that perhaps a member would like to call into the meeting.
Yes, and that you're going to need to notice that when you do your special meeting notice, that some members are going to be participating by phone, that they're going to be locations that people can go to listen in along with that person. So I want to make sure that Greg has all the, and Sally have all the information they need, depending on what kind of telephone meetings you want to be able to have. And it, and you would still have someone able to vote. You just have to be able to see, you know, kind of hear all the discussion.
And we just add one caveat. One other piece of that requirement is that if you permit a member to participate by phone, then any votes that the council would take would have to be roll call votes.
Yes. You were paying attention last time. You said, yes, you were right. So folks are already thinking about how to make it very user-friendly for all of you. It just takes a little planning on the outside. Okay. This is why this is important. There are penalties for violating the open meeting law. You have to, the enforcement really is through, someone would have to sue you anyway three times, and then you would forfeit your office, and there are the possibilities of fines and attorney's fees and costs. But even if you violate the open meeting law, the law does not allow for any overturning of any decision you made at a meeting that violated the law. So many citizens find that, you know, kind of are real lacking in the law. They also find the fact that you have to sue to enforce your rights is not exactly as friendly as it could be. So that is the big thing. Now, there is overlap around open meeting law and data practices, as I mentioned. So even if you have some not public data that you need to talk about, you can still be doing it in an open meeting. So, but I, as I mentioned, I don't expect you to have any private data that you're going to be talking about, so this really isn't that relevant. But know that you could do it if you had to. And now we're in the questions, and I think I'm not too bad on the 20 minutes. It really has been a flyby. So I just want you to be able to really kind of just think about this and issue spot, and as you have any questions as you're going forward, Gail would love to answer all these questions. I would as well, and reach out to Greg and your staff when you have any questions that you need help with. I think we also talked about records management, and that you'll have some official records as part of the work that you do here. For the most part, you know, Greg and Sally are going to keep all of those records. So when you eventually have, you know, kind of your minutes and your agendas and your recommendations, you know, that all that data is going to really be housed in Greg's office and maintained on your behalf, and so that you won't have any obligations to keep anything and produce anything after this work is done.
Questions?
Yeah. You mentioned that calling people sequentially,
yes,
would be a violation.
The court has said it might. They just said, really, people be cautious about trying to forge a majority in advance.
If it's for the purpose of forging a majority,
yes,
theoretically,
you can't have
and there's a lot. I mean, the devil is always in the detail in these cases. But if you were just calling people to say, what do you think about this? That would not be prohibited. If you would say, I'd like you to vote with me on this matter, that's going to be it. That's going to be sequential. Yeah.
So the salary council, I take it, moved the staffing. Greg as the entity, or I assume we're going to do the same as what the salary council did. So do you have that information for us?
Madam Chair, there's a standard policy that we will develop and ask you to consider and adopt at the next meeting. We'll send that out in advance so you can look at it.
And know also, it is always going to be okay for one of you or for your staff to send out an email that is just kind of one-way communication, like here are some materials I want folks to have or that you need. It's really that watching out for that reply all or having a discussion about any of the materials that you've received. So you could even say, here's an article I found super interesting. Like one way, totally fine. Or even running into people or saying, I saw this and I really thought it was interesting. But Gail is exactly right. That line about, hey, are you going to vote like this? And don't you think we should be more like Washington State and pay our folks twice as much or whatever the discussion is going to be?
Other questions? And please do raise questions along the line so we can get them over to Lori for the official response.
And know, too, that I hope that as you're working with each other, if you ever have any of those questions, like, just laugh. Just say, hey, didn't someone say we weren't supposed to do that? Because I think it's sometimes, like, socially it is just difficult when you feel like someone's just asked for your vote to really say, I don't think we're allowed to do that. So blame it on...
That's right. Yeah, there you go.
It's okay to just say, I don't think we're supposed to.
Wait a minute. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate the opportunity to be able to come and share this information with you. I'm happy to help in any way we can.
Thank you, Lori. That, I believe, is the fastest I've ever heard those two topics covered. So, very helpful. Okay, next we'll be talking about duties of the Compensation Council.
And yeah, Stephanie James.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephanie James, and I'm one of the lawyers who works in the Office of Senate Counsel Research and Fiscal Analysis. We're a nonpartisan office that serves the Senate. I'm going to talk to you about your duties and walk you through some of the questions that have often come up for this sort of council in the past. As you may know, you're sort of a reformulated council in the wake of the constitutional amendment that created the legislative salary council that sets legislator salaries. Your council now does not have the duty of setting legislator salaries. Instead, you're going to set the salaries of the executive officers of the state, which is the governor, the lieutenant governor, the secretary of the state, the auditor, and the attorney general. And you're also going to make recommendations on the compensation of judges and agency heads. Your organizing enabling statute is 15A.082. I believe Greg included a copy of that in your packets. What you're required to do is to make salary recommendations to the legislature for the constitutional officers and judges and recommend salary ranges for the heads of state and metropolitan agencies. There are two metropolitan agencies that are in your that we'll be making recommendations about, and that is the Metropolitan Council and the Metropolitan Airports Commission. And for agency heads, you will recommend a group that the agency head belongs in, and then maximum salary range for that group. And you'll express that as a percentage of the governor's salary. In 2016, the governor's salary was $127,000 and $127,629. Your recommendations are due to the legislature by April 1st. Once you've submitted your recommendations, they don't necessarily go into effect. The legislature has to take action in order for them to go into effect. Your recommendations for constitutional officers and judges will take effect the first Monday in January of the next odd-numbered year. It's not until January of 2019, and only if there is necessary money appropriated to pay for it by that time. You may recommend an increase in the following year for 2020 for constitutional officers and judges. Your recommendations for agency head salaries, however, are effective retroactively to January 1st of this year, again, provided they're enacted into law. The statute specifies things that you need to consider when you're making your recommendations. They include the amount of compensation paid in government service and the private sector to persons with similar qualifications, the amount needed to attract and retain experienced and competent persons, and the ability of the state to pay the recommended levels. Now, you may wonder why your recommendations don't take effect for constitutional officers and judges until 2 years later. One possible reason why your statute reads this way is that it's left over from the time when you had the charge to give recommendations for legislators. Under the Constitution, it wasn't possible for legislators to enact a pay raise for themselves. Any pay raise that they authorized for legislators couldn't take effect until the next biennium. And so I suspect that the statute, your statute, continues to have this two-year time gap as a holdover from that time. But there's also an issue of how it impacts the budget. Budget bills will be through deadlines by the end of March before your recommendations are due. And so it will be difficult for the budgets to take into account any increases that you might be recommending. If you get your work done very early, perhaps they can be considered for purposes of the budget. And, of course, because your recommendations are just that, recommendations, and require legislative action, it's possible for the legislature to say, even though their statute says these don't take effect until 2019, we like them and we're going to incorporate them this year. That's a possibility. It's also possible for the legislature to choose to not accept the recommendations or not follow the recommendations. Your council will dissolve once you have submitted your recommendations. You may, like anyone else, submit recommendations to your legislature about other topics or make recommendations outside the scope of your duties in your statute. However, they won't have any official standing, and again, the legislature might consider them, follow them, reject them, or ignore them. And the same is true if you submit your recommendations later than April 1st. Once you've submitted your salary recommendations, you can continue to meet, but you will no longer be able to get per diem payments or expense reimbursements or have administrative services. Any questions on that? Okay. Thank
I have a question on number 4, and this is the what the council is instructed by statute to consider. Is this generic instruction, or do you interpret this as specific?
Well, it's in your statute, so I would interpret it as something that you're required to consider. I'm quoted. Supplemental quotes exactly from your statute. So I haven't generified it.
Drill a little further. Okay. Just for an opinion, because I don't think there's anything written.
Yes, exactly.
And maybe we have guidance from the previous councils, but government service could be service outside of this state, or is it reflective only of this state?
I think that the statute doesn't constrain you to consider only.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. These are the basic. So the language of the statute is, in making compensation recommendations, the council shall consider the amount of compensation. But it doesn't in any way suggest we can't look much more broadly. Is there any role expected of council members in terms of presenting or testifying at the legislature?
There's nothing specified in statute about that.
And has that been a practice at all?
Yes, for someone to, yes. Your recommendations will be converted into a bill form, right? And we will help with that. And then that is typically presented in the state government committee or the government ops committee in that.
By the staff or the council?
I think by the chair.
Oh, okay. So that's something you can consider as you're thinking about this. Okay. Helpful. Other questions about this?
Are the in the spreadsheet here? There's a document from Ben Weeks on the
about salaries. In Group 1, salary limits are set at $172,463. Is that 133% of the current governor's salary?
This is an excellent opportunity for me to handle
this. Okay. And a similar one for Group 2 is at 120% of the governor's salary.
Madam Chair and members, those numbers are actually not 133 and 120% of the current governor's salary. What happened was in 2013, a law was enacted that set the governor's salary and set those two groups at 133% and 120% of that salary set in 2013, adjusted according to the Consumer Price Index each subsequent year. So it's actually now diverged a bit from what the 133 or 120% of the governor's salary would be. It's a bit higher in both cases.
So these numbers are a little higher than 133%?
That's correct.
Just returning to our prior topic for a moment, are there any other questions for Stephanie about the scope or role of the council? Okay. Jim. Do you prefer Jim or James?
Either one. Doesn't matter. I just want to make sure if Ms. James is leaving, I do have a question about, I think Mr. Hubinger can probably address this, the changes in membership, changes in responsibilities over the years. I think that detail would be helpful to the council, and also perhaps an explanation of why we didn't have recommendations in, I believe it was 15 and 11. I'm assuming Mr. Hubinger can answer that, but that just before you left, whoever should answer it, whenever it's timely.
We might talk about that when we walk through the spreadsheet. It might be helpful to do it in that context. Good question.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Stephanie. So we will move on to the salaries discussion.
I think I'll go first, and then Stephanie might add to that. You have a spreadsheet in your packet that's got the green bar on it, the dark and white lines. It's a landscape spreadsheet. I start out by apologizing for the small print. We wanted to show some amount of history here just so you got a sense about how things have evolved. The top several lines relate to the constitutional officers. The middle portion relates to the judges, and then the bottom line is for legislators. We can dispense with them first. The salaries for legislators were last increased in 1999, and the legislature has been unable, even though this compensation council has made numerous recommendations, the former compensation council that also included the responsibility of making recommendations on legislative salaries, made numerous recommendations to increase those salaries. And the legislature did not adopt any of them. And as a result, there was legislation passed a couple of years ago that put the constitutional amendment on the ballot that set a legislative salary council, also made up of 16 members, also appointed by the chief judge and by the governor. But that council will actually set those salaries, and they will become effective on July 1st. That council is in the process of doing its work right now. This council was retained, though, to make recommendations on salaries for constitutional officers and judges. You can see by the spreadsheet that there's been much more activity or many more increases in place for judges. Those have oftentimes followed or mirrored the recommendations of this council. The council has made recommendations every couple of years for constitutional officers. Those have been less followed by the legislature. So that's sort of the general framework here. Talking about the constitutional officers per se, the 2013 Compensation Council recommended 3% increases for the constitutional officers, and those were adopted in the 13 session and took effect 2 years later. The previous time that constitutional officer salaries were increased happened for the governor, not since 1998, when Arne Carlson was the governor. So there hadn't been much change in that 15 years. In 2003, the council had made a recommendation that the salaries of the other constitutional officers, the AG, the auditor, secretary of state, and lieutenant governor, be have an increase in their salaries based on a percentage of the salary of the governor. And so they were set as a percentage, the attorney general at 95%, the auditor at 85%, the secretary of state at 75%, and the treasurer at 65%. And that was adopted in law and resulted in increases in salaries for those other constitutional officers.
So these percentages were set in law. Is that within the realm of this council also to suggest other percentages, or is that outside the scope?
I believe that this council could recommend different percentages for those other constitutional officers.
So if I, Madam Chair, so if I understand, it was set as a percentage of the governor's salary, and subsequently the legislature added to it index. So the percentage of the governor's salary is no longer what they're paid because it's indexed to consumer prices.
Madam.
The second question maybe is, how's the governor's salary set?
Madam Chair and Stephen, the governor's salary is not indexed, and the other constitutional officer's salaries are tied as a fixed percentage of the governor's salary. So unless the governor's salary changes, these do not.
I was a little confused earlier then that they were indexed, and so they were no longer.
There's a different law that applies to salaries of agency heads, and those are indexed.
See. And the governor's salary is changed by what? What makes it different? What makes it increase?
An act of the legislature, generally in response to the recommendation of this council. And so the 2013 council recommended 3% increases in the two following years, and those were adopted by the 13 legislature and implemented.
Thank you.
So it seems that the percentages don't follow exactly cost of living increases, but they're relatively modest and kind of in that range. If this council reviewed this more broadly, I think this follows up on your question, and determined that really there should be a 30% increase in the governor's salary or a 10% decrease, that would be within the scope of this council's duties. Okay.
Sarah. It strikes me that, and I think it's my question is better understood if I explain why I'm asking it, that the big hang-up on any increase in the constitutional officer salary or the governor's salary has always been that the legislature has not had salary increases. So my question is, this other council that's actually setting it, when will that be set? Will that be set before our recommendations go to the legislature or after?
Madam Chair, Sarah, the other council's work must be by statute completed by March 15th, 2 weeks ahead of you.
Okay. So we will know whether the legislators are going to have an increase. Okay. Thanks.
Well, that's very helpful. Can I ask more? This is really a more generic question as well. Probably applies to both the agency head and constitutional officers and judges' issues. And that is, what kind of data might we look at from other jurisdictions as we're considering these things? And what kind of data might we look look to the private sector for? Is that typically provided to us?
Madam Chair, we've requested data from the National Conference of State Legislatures and the Council of State Governments, and they have data on salaries for constitutional officers and data on judges' salary and benefits. We'll provide that to you by the next meeting. Okay. We have a tougher time with private sector data that's relevant. It's not clear who the comparison groups are. We have a number of compensation folks here, and so they might be able to talk about that issue.
Madam Chair, Greg, could we also get the data from the National Center for State Courts? That is another body that puts together all that and give us just more information.
Madam Chair, and it would be helpful to have the equivalents of other airport authorities. And I don't know how we would do that council, given that that's kind of
the only one.
There isn't anything comparable in the country, right?
I'm not aware of anything.
That has that regional governance.
There might be
a lot of airport authorities are quasi-authorities. For example, Pittsburgh Airport is a quasi-airport authority of the city. I mean. So to the extent that that's comparable, that's available information.
One thing I would say is that if you are aware of resources like that you think we should be looking at, please raise them, because I think that
I think that the FAA would have the airport stuff, and that's a great point. They're all governed by completely different systems, but there must be some comparables in there.
There's an airport survey, and it breaks it out by size. This would be a large, because we're one of the top airports in the country. You have to be a member in order to get it. The airport would probably have access to that data.
Tom?
Madam Chair, this probably would open up a big can of worms, and we may not want to go there, but the whole concept of this tying all of these various agency heads, from the gambling control board to the airport person to the director of paramutual racing, somehow to the governor and all that percentages, is that fair game for us to talk about? We think the legislature should change that or could adopt that. I would think we could if we wanted to. I'm not saying we should yet, but I want to think about that a little bit. It seems to me it kind of grows like Topsy, and it isn't. It needs to be looked at some point by somebody. I would think it would be within our realm if we wanted to do it.
Greg, do you have a thought about that?
Madam Chair, it's clearly within the realm of this council to make recommendations about that. You will likely hear at your next meeting from Minnesota Management and Budget, which is responsible for all the compensation relationships in the executive branch, about their perspective on what ought to change or what ought not to change in terms of the agency heads.
Because they have done all of that work? Or because it's what fits into the budget? And I, of course, that's a relevant consideration. But.
And a previous council, 2011 or 2013, requested that MMB, Minnesota Management and Budget, do a compensation study of top managers, including agency heads. And I think they looked at private sector comparisons and across agencies. And so we could ask them to provide a review of that for you at a meeting.
Right. And if they could provide access to the document, too, there may be people who would be interested in reading that.
A question. Do we or will we have access to past summaries or findings as to why past councils did or did not increases and what they based their on?
Madam Chair and Anna, all of the council's recommendations for the last 15 years are posted on the council's website. So you'll at least see a little bit about their thinking about what the issues are and what the specific recommendations were. Sometimes submitting those to the legislature, you don't see exactly what the response is. You see the outcome, but not exactly what the thinking was.
So that might be good homework for all of us to glance through some of those so we have a sense of what has been covered or what hasn't been and where that's gone, just as an information piece.
Madam Chair and Greg, I just have one question about the statute that was quoted here about the number three, the ability of the state to pay the recommended levels. Are we provided with information about that? Because what I hear or see on the news about budgets. And
I anticipate that that would be something that MMB will present on at our next meeting. Is that correct?
We can ask them to do that.
Knowing that various parts of the budget are fungible, are movable, you know, that can't be a completely limiting factor, but yes.
Yeah, because I think two and three, I guess, are all kind of intertwined together. If you don't have the budget, you sometimes can't attract the experienced and competent people you want. Because I see that issue in other states with judges, that the pay isn't there, and you start seeing people appointed who I don't think are experienced and competent. Graduating right now in law school and almost being appointed judges, and you're thinking, how's that happen?
Yeah, well, I think those are really valid questions, Sarah.
While we're on the free-ranging subjects, have we ever, as a state equivalent bodies before us, ever tried tying judicial compensation to some form of grading? And is that done in other states?
Grading of any kind, or grading on, quality or outcome,
this is
or quantity?
Just ruminations if I'm going to be serving on this council, and I'm just wondering if there's ever been any mechanism by which, other than putting the judges up to the voters, which isn't bad, but if that's ever been done in other states.
State of North Carolina, we did a study for the judges in North Carolina, and they asked us to do it, and we refused. We don't know what the value parameters should be.
Right. It would be very difficult.
Problem.
All right. Just thought I'd raise it.
We said, well, somebody else made that decision. We're going to go with that one.
Madam Chair, there is an association of judges that will be asking to present their perspective on what salary changes ought to take place, and I imagine that might be on the agenda at our next meeting. So you'll hear from them.
Sure.
Mr. Robbins, Chair, is there information readily available? I know that the larger jurisdictions, cities and counties, provide the three highest salaried employees. Is that information readily available to us?
Madam Chair, Jim, are you thinking for local units of government, the top three paid for each of them?
Yes, those are disclosed. I know the Associated Press did a bit of freedom of information to gather that information. I was just wondering if we have that readily available to us. I think it's relevant in especially looking at the agency head salaries.
And I think it's common practice, especially perhaps more in outstate areas, to publish all public salaries, or at least top. It is. I know that from experience. That happens. But I think there's just a ton of data available. How it's organized may be a question for us. Tom?
Madam Chair, I follow up on an excellent question. I would ask also if we could get, because I think it relates to judicial salaries, in the top three or four paying counties, a county attorney, assistant county attorney, probably public defenders. I think there's some situations where some of those people are making more money, maybe significantly, than the judges they're appearing before, and it's something I think we just ought to be aware of and think about. So if you could find that, I assume it's readily available.
So one more question I have. Has there been a compensation philosophy articulated? This is it, or have any prior councils articulated a more comprehensive compensation philosophy? For example, Tom mentioned the question of being able to attract appropriate qualified people.
Apart from that sort of standard phrase, attracting and retaining, I don't remember any different language than that.
So no aim at being in the middle of the pack nationally or at 75% or anything like that. No. Okay, Steve?
Just to follow up on that, you're talking about salary information and I presume benefits, but is there information about turnover, which is often an indicator of whether or not you can retain?
Well, the other element of compensation that we haven't talked about is the benefits package, which obviously can influence somebody's decision about their interest in a position as well.
And Stephanie has a memo that she could walk through briefly that describes what the benefits are for each of these two groups, if you'd like to do that now.
And that would be great. I'm just suggesting that as we look at trying to compare salary data from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, the other benefits become relevant in terms of the way that I'm sure you deal with that all the time. Okay. So, Stephanie, why don't you go ahead and give us a little overview of that.
Madam Chair, members, this is the memo that is titled Total Compensation Packages for Constitutional Officers and Employees. This is very brief and just highlights a few additional components of compensation that officers and judges receive. Constitutional officers are in the unclassified employee retirement plan. It is a defined contribution plan that requires employees of the 25.5% of their salary to the benefit of retirement as a function of their age, of the employee's age of retirement, and the value of their age. In addition, constitutional officers are covered by the same insurance benefits that all state employees have. Those include health, dental, and term life insurance. In addition, officers have the option of participating in a preferred comp plan. And finally, the governor's compensation includes the use of a residence and a car and a drive. Similarly, judges are covered by a retirement plan, and the Pensions Commission staff is going to provide you with a lot more detail about the retirement benefits for judges, as well as more on the retirement benefits for constitutional officers. And then judges are covered by the same insurance benefits that are offered to state employees, the health, dental, and term life. And they have the option of participating in a deferred compensation plan.
I have. what's the contribution to the health plan by the state? Is it 100% of family or 80%? Or do you know?
Madam Chair and Jim, the state pays 95% of the premium for an individual and 85% of the premium for family coverage. We can get you a table that shows what the value of those two packages. It's about $16,000 for family coverage and about $7,000 for the individual.
Thank you.
Other questions or suggestions of what we might want to be looking at? Should we move on to the agency?
Should we talk about the salaries for judges?
Sure. Yes.
Going back to the landscape spreadsheet, to talk about the judges for a moment, the Compensation Council's recommendations for salaries for the judiciary have been followed by the legislature at a much higher rate than they have for the other constitutional officers. The 2013 council recommended 4% increases over a four-year period in each year for the judges, and that recommendation was largely adopted, except for the second year when, instead of a 4%, the judiciary received a 3%. I should point out that there is a blank spot in your chart between July 2008 and July of 2013, sort of the Great Recession period. The Compensation Council met twice during that period and recommended that judges receive increases that averaged the same as state employees received, but that was not adopted by the legislature. So there was a four-year period in there when judges did not receive any increases at all. In the middle of judges is the set of increases from July 1st of 2005 through July of 2008. There was a series of four increases in there. Those increases were recommended by the 2005 Compensation Council. And then you can see the history of the frequency of the increases for earlier periods on the left. There was a period when the council was recommending that judges receive the same increases as the average of state employees, and that happened. That was implemented in July of 99 and January of 2000. That was an experiment where judges' salaries were tied to what other state employees were getting, and that was adopted for one time period.
So, would it be fair to say that the council recommendations for in 2013 and 2005 might be instructive in terms of what council thought needed to happen with judge salaries?
I think that's fair, yes.
Chair, so where we see the percentages 1, 5, 3, 3, those were the recommendations, and that's what was adopted, or were there times when there was a percentage and it wasn't adopted?
Matt and Chair and Robert, the percentages that are shown are the actual increases that were implemented, and they're may have been some variations from what the council recommended. We haven't tried to do a chart of recommended versus implemented through time. That'd be kind of an interesting exercise.
It would, because I don't want our activity to be for naught. And I'm just wondering, you know, what's the tolerance of the legislature for the recommendations?
Right.
Yeah. And can I just ask for clarification for the district court judges? It's a flat salary amount regardless of the number of years served in that role. Is that correct?
Yes.
Other questions or? Yeah.
Just make a comment. This is Jim Robbins. In fairness to the other councils, keep in mind that 2005 and 2013 were really good budget surplus years, so there may have been issues, especially in 2009, where the recommendations were just fine. It's just a matter of the budget situation didn't allow for it.
All right, let's move on to the agency head issue.
So I can take you through briefly agency head salaries. I'm working through a 10,000-foot view of the January 29th memo. It says Minnesota House of Representatives in the upper right corner, and it says January 29th, 2017, titled agency head salaries within the council's jurisdiction. A bit more nuanced than the other salary recommendations made by this council. So in broad terms, oh, and again, my name is Ben Weeks, for the record. I work at the Nonpartisan House of Representatives Research Department. I'm a lawyer and legislative analyst for them.
You may need to speak up a bit.
Okay, too, I will speak up. So the Compensation Council, this council, makes recommendations of ranges of salaries for agency heads. And so agency heads, in general, are the chief executive of state administrative agencies and those two metropolitan agencies that Stephanie mentioned, the Met Council and the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Statute requires that these ranges, which are generally maximums rather than min-max ranges, are expressed as a percentage of the governor's salary. Currently in law, they're classified into three different groups, each set at a different percentage of the governor's salary, with two of those being increased according to the Consumer Price Index, as I had mentioned earlier. The third one's flat, not increased. Those groups are on pages 2 and 3 of the memo, and that's reflective of the statute looks exactly like that. So this council recommends ranges and recommends which group an individual agency head should be put into. The legislature then adopts those, puts those ranges into law, or doesn't. Then the appointing authority, who for the vast majority of these is the governor, and appointing authority just means the person who hires and fires. It's the governor for the vast majority of these. There's a couple that are appointed by boards, the pensions board being one. The governor sets a specific salary for each agency head, and then that specific salary comes back to the legislature for approval through the LCC and a subcommittee that the LCC has set up for that purpose called the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. They either that subcommittee either approves or does not approve the salary, and then it goes to the full body of the House and the Senate for final approval. And that's how agency head salaries are set in very broad terms.
Will MMB be providing information to us on average tenure of the various roles? You know?
I don't know if they specifically plan to. I mean, they have the capability of pulling some of those numbers. It wouldn't be difficult.
I think that would be helpful. It would also be helpful, perhaps mostly in the judicial category, to know whether there's a turnover issue. Judges.
Yep.
Madam Chair, there's another spreadsheet on the back of Ben's memo that talks about that shows the history of salaries that are paid to agency heads, and it might be helpful just to walk through that spreadsheet for a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. Again, as Ben said, the role of this council is to recommend ranges for agency heads, and to see that part of the spreadsheet, look about three-quarters of the way down in the lower right-hand corner, there's a little table that shows 133, 120, and 25%, and it shows the by over the next four-year period what those dollar amounts mean. And so those are the maximum of the ranges for the agency heads as a percentage of the governor's salary, and as Ben indicated, those are indexed by inflation. This was a recommendation that was made by the 2013 Compensation Council and was adopted by the legislature and passed into law.
Can you speak in more detail about all the machinations in 2015 about the changes in agency salary? Because it would kind of went back and forth, as I recall. The governor established them, the legislature rejected that, and then the governor reestablished them.
So, yeah. So it's a little bit out of your bailiwick because your role is to to recommend ranges.
Right.
Within those ranges, the issue that Gail was talking about in terms of what the salaries were was sort of a result of, there was a fair amount of machination around that in 13 through 15. The 2013 legislation gave the governor the ability to set the salaries of his agency heads anywhere within the range. And Governor Dayton provided modest increases in 13 and 14 of 5%, I think. And then in 15, he did, after a compensation study, did significant increases of 30% or so. That was not received well by the legislature and sought to roll that back in the 15 session. And there was discussion and then a compromise where you can see on 2/27/2015, the salaries went back to the level they were back in 2014, and then the governor had 6 months to increase the salaries to whatever level he wanted. He put them exactly where they were. But as part of the compromise, the governor gave up the ability to set the salaries within the range, and we're back to the system that Ben described, where the governor recommends increases for his agency heads, but they have to be reviewed by the legislature and then ratified by the full legislature.
I think it does go to the issue, though, of tolerance of the legislature for whatever recommendations this group might make.
Yes. I point out a couple of other things. As Ben indicated, the bulk of the agency heads here are for the major agencies that have hundreds or thousands of employees. Most of them then are in Group 1, which is 133% of the salary of the governor. If you look closely within that, there's an array of salaries that are basically in three groups. So the maximum is now $172,000. There's one group that's at $154,000, another group that's at $150,000, and another group at $144,000. And that reflects what the governor believes is an appropriate salary for those three groups of large agency heads. So within Group 1, there's three subsets where the governor has determined that salaries are appropriately set. I also point out that since the maximum is 154 and the current maximum salary actually being paid is 154 and the maximum of the range is 172, there's a fair amount of room for the governor to propose increases within the existing ranges. As we said, Minnesota Management Budget will be coming to a future meeting and presenting their thoughts about what the ranges ought to be.
Sarah? Are we having a wide open discussion on all of these, or are we going to get there eventually? I have a question about one category.
Well, I think we probably won't get into an in-depth discussion today about
this. Might require
all of them,
a little staff research.
Well, and I think it might inspire future questions. So
okay.
Go ahead.
So the mystery to me has always been the Public Utilities Commission. We have five commissioners. It's my understanding. They'd be commissioners. It's my understanding it's not a full-time job.
It is a full-time job. Well, it is for the chair, at least.
Yeah, I can see where it probably is for the chair. But I guess I would like to have a bit of history on the salary of that one.
And will that be part of MMB's study?
Yeah, okay. Or we'll at least ask that they present information about that rationale or that issue.
So I think I would be interested in seeing that compensation study from MMB probably before they do their presentation.
Yeah, we can email it to you.
Yeah.
For some of you, it'll be fun reading. Some of it's kind of geeky, but
I'm sure it's all going to be geeky. You're all geeks, right? Come on.
Sorry.
Well, we can get geeky on you if you want to. Mm-hmm. Over there.
Questions?
I just have one.
Comments? Jessica?
You had mentioned that the 30% increase in the 2015 year was based on a compensation study plan that the governor received. Was he following those recommendations from the compensation study, or did he go above and beyond and that kind of create the conflict?
So you're asking if the actual salary increases that the governor granted to his agency heads followed the compensation study that he did? That's a good question to ask MMB, I think, when they're here.
Okay. Other questions today about agency? So.
Madam Chair and Greg, the other agency heads, these are not within the scope of this council. These are just informational purposes. MUNSCU, Chancellor, Teachers Retirement Association.
That's correct. Those are outside.
Outside. Okay.
Up until a couple of years ago, these were all part of that larger list, but they've been pulled out by the legislature.
Yeah, some years ago for Chancellor.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, we're doing pretty well here. We have reserved a place on the agenda for testimony. I don't think we have any. Do we? Okay. Well, so now we have opportunity for council discussions. Before we leave today, we have a number of business items to come back to: electing the chair, scheduling our next meeting. We've talked about data that we would like. There are other requests. We can talk about those as well. Need to get your blue form and your W-9 done, if possible, today before you leave. We need to appoint the responsible authority and the DPC, the Data Practices Compliance Official, for this council. And then also, I think at the next meeting, we would be looking at the policy on responding to data requests. Is that correct? Okay. So we'll open it up for discussion. I appreciate the questions and comments that have already been made. I think those are helpful for us to, as we start to get our heads around what we're going to be doing here and how we might want to do that. But thoughts that you'd like to share, just questions that you have that you'd like to put out there. One of the discussion suggestions I'm going to make is it's okay to put a question out without owning the answer or without owning a particular direction, or even putting an idea out just for discussion and maybe counterpoint or illumination without having to own that. So. Any thoughts?
Madam Chair, I have a thought. I think back to a comment that you made earlier, which I think will be difficult, but when an organization establishes salaries, they establish some comparative group. And while it might be instructive to look at all other states and as much private sector data as we can, I'm thinking we're not going to look at Mississippi. We're not going to look at Florida. We're not going to look at New York and California. So it may be instructive just talk about other states that are comparable to us, understanding also that these people that might occupy these positions are probably not on the open market as most people are. This is a kind of a limited group. And so the market is not, well, we could get somebody from Wisconsin, so let's go attract that person. It may occur in some situations, but probably not. But I think there are certain states that we probably are comparable to, certain counties that we may be comparable to for certain jobs, and others that we should, nice to know about, but we don't need to be comparable to. I think that ought to be part of our discussion. It may be important to do that initially if we can, but I understand that when people have data, then they can form a better choice than ideologically.
Well, I think it's important as well that we not over-inform ourselves, that if we take in too much data, it will just overwhelm our discussion and be more difficult to find the path, as well as burdening the staff who are going to be trying to assemble all of this for us. So I think, Greg, one thing you might consider for the next meeting is identifying those things that we have readily available. If there are data requests that we've made today that would require considerable different research and so forth, I think we need to do that before we decide whether that's really necessary. Does that make sense to everybody?
Madam Chair, I'd like to add, data is very important and it's often very persuasive, but there also needs to be a qualitative analysis or a qualitative judgment. And I don't know how you get to that. Sometimes it's just anecdotal, or maybe somebody on the staff here or on the council here can speak to, you know, what the pressures, what the stress on this kind of a judge, that kind of a judge, or agency head. And so we ought to consider that as well.
I hope that some of that would be, at least for the agency head issue, would be addressed by the MMB study, the compensation study that they did a couple of years ago, but we'll see. We don't know. And is there anything that the Supreme Court has done on judicial salaries that we'll be getting?
Madam Chair, there's national data, and is there other data that the courts are going to want to bring in?
Their economist report.
Oh, right.
The what?
Economist report. The District Judges Association has economists who make recommendations and review per year statute nationally, statewide, your prosecutor salaries. They'll come and share that information with you, and the economist will come.
Okay. And there's a written report that contains this. Is that something that could be sent out electronically beforehand? Okay, great.
Could you identify yourself just for the recording, please?
Sure. My name is Nancy Haas. I'm a lobbyist with Messerly & Kramer, and I represent the Minnesota District Judges Association.
But there is... To your knowledge, or Greg, to your knowledge, there's not some official statement from the Supreme Court itself about a recommendation.
If I may, the Judicial Council has made a recommendation to the governor for judicial salaries at 3.5 and 3.5, so you can have that information. And generally, the Supreme Court doesn't generally come over and testify on pay raises.
Sarah?
Just a general observation and my personal bias so people know where I'm coming from. I hope we don't spend a whole lot of time on comparable sectors in the private sector. I think that, and the reason I say that is that I think it's comparing apples and oranges. I think government jobs that aren't elected or appointed are stable, the paycheck always comes, you don't have to go ask for the clients or hustle the money to get it in the door, the health care is always there. And I think to some degree that gets under appreciated in some ways, which is not to say I'm usually in favor of more pay for government servants, but I think that a lot of, at least the intel I've done, lawyers in the private sector, this is a pretty good gig being a district judge.
Well, I think that's there are mixed opinions about that, and
yeah.
We'll probably hear about those, yes. Other thoughts about that? I think that goes, several of these comments actually go to this notion of a compensation philosophy and the kinds of things that would be considered. And so that could be one, you know, where the group would end up on that, don't know, but maybe we should try to... keep track of those factors as we're going along.
I have a question. Have district judges always had the same salary no matter which district they're in? So in other words, I mean, I would think a district like Hennepin would be very high volume compared to...
Well, they're by judicial districts, so...
Well, okay. Yes, they're the same statewide.
They
are the same statewide.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if ever, because the... As I recall, the judicial system was reformed 20 or 30 years ago in terms of whether it was counties paying and state paying, at least for staff. I don't remember if that was true for judges or not. But I would say, and I don't know what the volume of cases is, for example, in northwestern Minnesota, but I do know it's difficult to attract judges in certain parts of the state. And their caseloads might be just as high, mm-hmm. might be more diverse than a judge in Hennepin County or Ramsey County. Mm-hmm. other things you're thinking about that you think should come up as we...
Well, that was an interesting question or comment.
Yeah.
When the number of judges is established, is it just according to districts, or does it take into effect the population of the district?
My recollection, well, you may want to address this. Do you want to talk about this today?
Why don't you come up so we get to catch you on that.
And again, why don't you put your name first? So,
thank you. Nancy Haas with Messerly and Kramer on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association. The question about judgeships, each judgeship has to be approved and funded by the legislature. And so, you know, that entails not only a judge, but a court reporter and a law clerk. And so the court, through their budget process, makes recommendations about what their needs are based on an annual weighted caseload study. And so when our folks come and testify, we could provide a little bit more information if you were interested in how that looks statewide.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? Do you collect information with respect to how many people apply for open judicial positions through the...
We don't, since that's a function of the executive branch and the governor's office. We do regularly consult with the chief judges who receive information, and so you will hear testimony from the district judges anecdotally about the challenges and how many...
Of hiring staff, you're talking about.
No, you're asking about judges.
Because I know there's, you know, there's an application process. Does anyone track that information?
Well, that's the Judicial Selection Commission, really, that does that. Which is okay. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Correct. You know, the chair of the judicial selection process, appointed by the governor, you know, may have those stats. I don't know that they've ever been published. We the district judges can come and testify and share with you the you know, what they've heard throughout the state on if you have a judgeship in the 9th district, for example, northwestern Minnesota, and you have three judges or three candidates apply for one opening, or in, you know, the 10th judicial district where you may, you know, used to have 30 applicants for one application. So we'll get to, I think, your question. But as to the data, that's contained with the Judicial Selection Commission, and I'm not sure if they share that information.
I have a quick question here. Is it... How do we solicit testimony from, for example, from someone from another commission? So, for example, if we wanted to have someone come in from, the Judicial Selection Commission come in and offer testimony, do we have, like, subpoena power to have them come in, or how do we obtain that information?
I don't believe that we have subpoena authority. However, I believe the Judicial Selection Commission is not subject to the Data Practices Act. However, we can certainly make a request if we want that information.
So I assume that, Nancy, your group is going to come and give us testimony. It would be helpful to know who all plans on coming to give us testimony in case, so we can look at a list and see if we think we're missing anybody as soon as we know them.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So we know MMB.
Yep.
Okay. We know judicial panel.
Those are the only two that we know of at this point.
And the excuse me, Madam Chair, the judicial panel will be the District Judges Association, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Not the appellate courts, or the intermediate appellate court, or the Supreme Court.
I could mention that the members of the District Judges Association include the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. What we can also provide for you is the judges' the Judicial Council's recommendation to the governor and the governor's budget recommendation, which will include a payment.
Okay. Jim?
Jim Robbins. Do we have a perspective available to us from the legislature, given the situation in 15, and we have partisan difference? We do have the MMB providing us their impact. Do we have some way of inviting legislative leadership?
So you're asking about the possibility of having legislative representatives come in to give their perspective on salary increases or salary changes,
I
should say?
Well, I guess it would be the perspective of the finance chair that in each in the House and the Senate, or obviously there was quite the differential in 15, and I'm sure MMB will do their best, but they are representing the governor. So I'm just curious how we get that viewpoint. I'm really at a loss how to do that. I'm not trying to guide the question.
Right. Well, and I'll just put out another question to mull over at the same time, and that is that I assume in some respects we keep the budget in mind, reality in mind, as we're going forward, and I assume your question really is whether their input would help us define what that reality is. But this group wouldn't strictly be looking at what the budget pressures are either. We're looking at compensation that's fair and leads to quality and attracts the right candidates and so forth.
Yes. Madam Chair, to that point, I would suggest that
I think this whole body was set up by statute to not get too much involved in either the partisan bickering or what somebody thinks that we can afford and can't afford. And we are designed to do, I would guess, so our independent judgment on those factors that we needed, I don't think about that, and take our chances with how well they do it. I mean, we'll kind of all read the newspapers and listen to the TV, but I got a hunch the whole purpose of this is for us to be kind of independent and come up with our own ideas about this and give them advice as to what we think our collective judgment is about that, and then they have to fit it into the budget.
I think I really agree with that. And the legislature obviously will have its own hearings at which MMB and perhaps the governor will testify about their feelings about it, and legislators will have an opportunity to voice theirs. But we can hold that as a question going forward if we want to do that.
Sure.
Yes.
One other piece is that I don't know how intentional it was, but the predecessor for this had four legislators on it. And so the council would have heard their perspectives on all of the recommendations that were being made. And because this council no longer deals with legislative pay, because they wanted the Chief Judge and Chief Justice and the governor to make the appointments, the legislators were removed. That doesn't, and perhaps I'm reflecting my legislative bias here, I'm not sure why the council would not want to hear from finance committee chairs or judiciary committee chairs, for example, about what their perspective on this pay ought to be.
Okay. David.
Part of it, if I understand her comments correctly, is that there's a budget that includes an increased dollar amount for pay, is that right?
I guess so, yes.
So part of what we're supposed to consider is the cost of the budget as a whole. If they could offer a perspective on how that would fit in, maybe it would be helpful.
Okay. Stephanie had a comment, too.
Sure.
Madam Chair, just another thought. There's nothing that prohibits some informal communication between the chair and then of this commission and then the chairs of the relevant committees in the bodies, the finance chair and certainly the other chairs, as the group coalesces around the direction that you're going to go, to give them the heads up where you're headed and to encourage them to include some money for targets for the agency heads. And,
okay. That will be a good discussion. Other thoughts? Questions.
How often are we going to be meeting?
There's not a set number of times you anticipate 5 or 6 meetings?
The average is 4.
4?
And it's gone from between 3 and 6, I think.
They will be how long, or depending on the, as long as we want to sit here, right?
Exactly.
Maybe we could do a little estimate when we plan the meeting.
Yes, I think we will need to.
Because there's so many people from out of town, and people have other things to do.
Right, and we need to know how many things we're going to be able to fit into the agenda for each meeting as well. And maybe we'll have a better sense of that after the 2 presentations at the next meeting. Or should we... should we confine ourselves at the next meeting only to agency head salaries or only to judicial salaries or constitutional officers? Do we want to handle those separately, or do we want to kind of dip into each area?
I would say at this point, let's have as much information fed us, and then we can figure out how to subdivide it.
Okay. And let's turn the fire hose on, and we'll sort it out.
Okay. So you'll put that on the agenda for... Okay, good. Well, that's great. Let's move on to our business items that we need to wrap up here. Let's first do election of the chair. We welcome self-nominations as well as nominations by others. If you've already got your lawn sign out and we're just not aware of it, we would like to know that now. But please don't be shy here.
I'd like to nominate Tom Berg.
All right, Tom Berg is nominated.
I would like to second that, Madam Chair, because I'm very concerned about people having experience with the legislature, because I don't want us to be floating out there in an imaginary ideal world. I want it to be practical.
Okay. Madam Chair, I appreciate that, but my legislative experience was before a few of you were born, I suspect.
That back here, I'd be happy to do it if you want.
The tone might have changed, but I bet the process hasn't changed at all.
So you learned nothing in the process.
I wrote a book about it.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah. Now we've got you.
Are there other nominations? For this purpose, I'm going to follow Robert's rules and ask at least 3 times. So are there other nominations for chair? Anyone else that's interested in putting their name forward?
Hey, just a point of order, do we ever have a vice chair?
It'd be helpful, I think, from the staff perspective, to have a vice chair in case the chair has to be out of town or is ill, and we can still have someone that can convene and run the meeting.
And we are appointed in a partisan way, and if we did do that, we might want to balance it. We would want to balance it, I think.
I was a DFL legislator, so everybody knows my side of things.
I'm not sure all the appointments are partisan, but they're obviously by people of different parties. Okay, well, let's finish the chair. Are there other nominations for chair? All right. Hearing none, let's vote on Mr. Berg as chair of the council.
Should I put my head on my
don't watch. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Sir, you are elected. Would you like to...
No, I'd like you to continue on for the rest of this meeting.
Oh, I see. Okay. I've got the next.
Delegate that. You got the gavel there, and you're doing just fine.
All right.
And I like the vice chair idea. I think that'd be
I think it's a great idea. So are there nominations for vice chair? Again, don't be shy if you're interested.
I will nominate Dr. Fox if he's willing.
Sure.
This is James Robbins, DFL, St. Paul.
All right. And Steve, you had your hand up.
I was going to nominate Gail Olson since she had a certain facility as chair.
Yes, thank you. Well, think I'll defer to Mr. Fox.
Very good.
Dr. Fox, sorry.
Whichever.
Other nominations? Thank you, Steve. All right. All those in favor of James Fox serving as vice chair, say aye.
Aye.
You going to put your head down?
And no.
You want to know the truth.
I want to know my friends here.
All right. Anyone opposed? All right. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think that's an excellent idea. So be able to move forward. All right. Great. Let's schedule our next meeting. We'll be looking at about 2 weeks out or... we have a kind of a short time frame here.
Madam Chair, members, just from the staff perspective and our other responsibilities, a Monday morning or a Friday are better for us, and we're balancing the other council instead of our spare time. One suggestion would be whether Friday the 17th would be available for you.
In the afternoon, morning, just any time.
And for the people who have to travel for greater Minnesota, I don't know if morning is easier or afternoon and getting back.
Let's ask that. What's the earliest that would be convenient for you who are traveling?
Earliest in the day? 9 is...
9 is doable. Is that true for everyone?
The... Here we go. I have a board meeting I have to be at on the 17th that day. I guess in the morning at least. Is it Monday a possible around then?
That would work. Which day are we looking at again?
Or how about Friday? How about that afternoon?
Or the 17th?
Were you suggesting Monday the 13th?
Yeah. Well, I guess I would suggest that. I don't know.
I would prefer the Monday.
Me too.
Yeah. Does Monday the 13th work for most of you?
Back to morning or afternoon?
Morning or afternoon?
Morning.
Morning.
Get it done with, huh? Start the week out right.
I'd be worried about traffic. We might want to... Is it possible a little later?
Oh,
I mean, it's not traffic for me. I placed 9 as the earliest because of my concern about traffic. But you can choose what you like.
Monday, February 13th. Should we look at 10 o'clock? Would that be better for people?
Yes.
No?
Yes.
I wouldn't be able to attend on Monday the 13th.
Okay.
Do we need just a quorum to continue? Obviously, not everyone may or may not be able to be
here. That's correct.
Yeah.
We're just, we have some flexibility, so trying to accommodate everybody if we can. Tom, does the afternoon of the 17th work for you? Not so much?
Not so much. 13th is much better.
Okay.
On my take.
Jessica, I'm sorry, but I think we're going to have to go with the 13th.
That's fine.
Okay. Right.
The afternoon of the 13th would be fine, just not the morning.
You can phone in.
Oh, the afternoon would be preferable? Would the afternoon of Monday the 13th work for everyone?
Sure.
Yes.
Sure. Then we will do Monday, and we'll start at 1 o'clock. Does that work for you? Does it work for staff?
Yes.
Okay.
Would it be possible to do 1:30? I can come. Is it
you have a lunch plan?
Yeah, I do have a lunch meeting.
Okay.
So can I, or I could just come late, obviously, like I did today. So.
I suspect that's going to be a pretty busy meeting, right?
I think so. I think we should plan on maybe 3 hours that day. Is that acceptable?
Mm-hmm. 3 or 6, so we avoid traffic.
So what time do we decide?
Nobody works anymore, so it's always.
Okay.
What? What time?
1 o'clock on Monday the 13th.
Then I have
block, hopefully.
I'll just be late.
Okay. I have a request. It's very hard to, as I age, I can't hear people. Can we have a room that has mics that we can hear
and
each
amplify?
Other? Amplify? Particularly as we get into a deep discussion, it's going to be very difficult to... We need better acoustics in the room.
Or a U-shaped?
Well, I think we should be speaking into microphones and amplified a little bit, because I think that interest, public interest, may grow in what we're doing, and there's nothing more annoying than sitting in the back row and not being able to hear. It feeds paranoia.
So we will check on that possibility. I agree with you completely about that.
So do I, and my hearing aids do too, so I'm with this era.
I'm trying to avoid those, but I'm getting close.
Yeah.
And members, there are fewer hearings on Monday mornings and on Fridays generally. So we will try to do what we can. We should be able to, we try really hard to get a room with mics, because we all, staff also agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Don't these mics work?
These record only.
Oh. That's one of the budgets. No idea. And should we try to set the next meeting as well?
That would be great as far as we're concerned.
Yes.
I think it'd be great for everybody's scheduling purposes. Should we look at 2 weeks out from there?
Yep.
Which would be Monday the 27th. Monday the 27th, afternoon, same schedule?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's good.
That's great.
And thank
actually,
you.
Actually, for purposes of the calendar.
You want to just keep going?
Keep going, yeah.
So then we'd be looking at March 13th.
I'd miss that one.
I'd miss that, too. I think I'll be
able to spring break.
Could we do that after break. The 15th so we have the other recommendation?
That's a good idea.
On the 20th, that would work.
20th, yeah, I could do that.
What's our deadline?
Just checking that. April 1.
Ugh. April 1. That's a little late, then. We might have to get another one.
We may need two quick ones. One...
Yeah.
Maybe we should pencil in the 13th. I don't know if anybody can make that, and then have one on that next Monday or that Friday after the other committee is reported in.
How many people did we have that couldn't be there on the 13th?
Of March.
Two. Okay.
Three.
All right.
Four.
I'm a little iffy on the 13th.
You're a little iffy.
Yeah. But that could work. I can call in if need be or something.
Okay, well, let us plan that tentatively at this point.
March 13th?
March 13th and...
How about and the 20th?
And the 20th.
That would be after that other recommendation. I think that's a good idea and still give us a little time to...
Why don't we look at something a little earlier than the 13th to give us... more than a week, because I do think the spring break issue is a problem. Do we want to look at the Friday instead?
I know it's a staffing headache, but if we do those 2 days, the last 2 days, I can't make those. Can we do if that's the way it is, that's the way it is, but is there some way to check everybody's availability and see what works best for the majority other than having a discussion?
Stafford has
is it the Monday part that's the problem? Or just those 2 days?
One day I'm tentatively in New Orleans for a conference, and then the 20th afternoon I'm booked with meetings.
What if
I have
the
to
17th
to.
In the afternoon?
You still run into the spring break conundrum?
Yeah.
Maybe a show of hands.
What about the
March 17th?
What about the prior week, the 9th?
Yeah, maybe a show of hands. That's a good idea. Efficient.
Or you've got the scheduling thing. Why don't we?
Should we do the?
Why don't
doodle?
We look at the scheduling thing?
I hate to make work for
we're
you.
We're looking at tentative dates at this point, anyway. So, we'll try that for the two meetings after that. So, right now, plan on the 13th and 27th of this month at 1 o'clock, and plan on going till 4. And if we can get you out before rush hour, we will. How about that? Mr. Chair, does that sound...
That sounds perfect.
All right.
And I'm sorry, did you have dates specifically for the doodle? For polling for the two meetings that followed that? I couldn't tell if there were specific recommendations.
Well, we could look at the 9th and the 13th.
Okay. Did you say for the doodle?
Yes, we sent you one. It's an online calendar.
It's a spreadsheet where you say what works and what doesn't.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
The 9th and the 13th.
Check your email.
And David, what is the spring break dates?
I don't know. That's not an issue for me.
Oh, okay.
I think it's the 13th to the 17th, I think.
Okay.
I think that's it's different for depending on what school district you're
talking. Yeah, it is.
Sarah, the 17th or in March, the 17th or the 20th didn't work for you, was that it?
I like the idea of getting one reasonably close after that.
17th works for me.
17th doesn't work for me, and that is St. Patrick's Day, so St. Paul will be a little crazy. Not affect the Capitol Hill, huh?
Not this end of
St.
Paul.
You don't even know what's going on. Sorry.
That's always true.
What's a woman named Olson know about St. Patrick's
Day?
Yeah, that's
true. Anyway. That's true.
Every meeting space will be available.
Yes.
Okay, we'll check those dates. And
Holy Mac, Friday the 17th, it's the 17th, that's going to be a wild St. Patty's Day.
And do we need to have one that lasts either that following Monday or Friday, just reserved, either the
27th or the 31st.
24th or 27th?
27th. That's a good idea.
Speaking as an out-of-towner, I would say I prefer longer and fewer sessions.
Yes, okay. I think we're just looking at reserving times. Maybe we'll finish in three meetings. Somehow I don't think so, but okay. We'll check on those.
Okay.
Who's and we can come back to that at the next meeting if we need to. I'm sorry.
Who writes the report?
Right. Good question.
Staff gets direction from the chair to draft something that's presented to the council.
Okay, so we talked about data that we're requesting. If you think of other things, let's bring that to the next meeting, and we can sort through all the requests we've made, see what's essential. Blue form, W-9, talked about that. I think the other thing we could do today is appoint the data practices responsible authority and the data practices compliance official. And do I hear a nomination that Greg Hubinger would fill those two roles?
You do.
Did I hear
you
that?
Do.
Yes.
And did I hear a second?
You did.
Second. I thought so.
I think it was unanimous.
You heard a vote.
I think the vote is unanimous. Hearing no objection, Greg, will you be willing to serve in that role?
Happy to. And we'll draft a policy for you to adopt at your next meeting that implements that.
Okay. Other issues we need to talk about today? Yeah.
As I read the materials, so is our service done essentially after April 1st, and then a new crowd comes in the following year?
2 years.
Two years. We serve for 2 years?
No, the new crowd comes in.
It's done
two
every
years.
2 years, yeah.
Okay.
But you have a 2-year term. But if the council completes its work early, you dissolve then.
So, yeah, we can hold on to this as long as you'd like. Until April 1st.
Kind of like a mayfly.
The salary council is for 2 years. They're staggered.
Permanent.
I believe they have 4-year terms. 4 years. Half of the members were appointed for 2-year terms to get some split.
And just out of curiosity, I just want to ask if ever there was a decision that these functions were a single function, how difficult would it be to stagger the years in terms of 1 year being the legislative and 1 year being what we do? Not that we have any control over that. I'm just curious.
Madam Chair and Jim, the timing is such that both groups are doing their work, would do their work now and make recommendations that fit into the budget cycle, so it would make more sense for them to be running parallel.
Okay, any other business to do today? We're in a little past three. Thank you for your indulgence, and thanks for being here. Well, look forward to our meeting.
Thank you.
For adjourned.
Thank you, everybody.
One thing with the blue shiny is you can just circle thanks. Yes for per diem. Forgot to mention that. So you, if you want.
I actually came. I was going to pass a note as to if you wanted to do it.
I'm going to be the parent.
A few years now?
Okay.
We'll get one out.
No, I think there's
everybody's got each other's email. So we can file. We can file.
Yeah, everyone's changing.